Hello, and welcome to Historically Speaking, Uncommon History with an Unconventional Pair. I'm Rebecca Robbins.
And I'm Kim Kimmel.
I'm a singer and actress.
And I'm a retired history teacher.
He was my history teacher in college.
And now we've been married for 21 years.
Sometimes quirky, sometimes obscure.
But this is the kind of history you actually want to remember.
Hello, and welcome to episode 26 of Historically Speaking Podcast.
Wow, 26 episodes.
Yep, we're getting up there. Today is actually, it's kind of part two.
Yes, it is.
We didn't intend it to be a two-part series, but this is the famous spies who are of the male persuasion.
That's right. We're dealing with three male spies, very famous spies in history.
Awesome.
Okay.
Who are we starting with?
Well, we're starting with a 16th century figure. This is Sir Francis Walsingham.
I've heard of him.
We're not quite sure what year he was born, probably 1532, but it was sometime in the early 1530s. He would die in 1590, in his late 50s. Sir Francis Walsingham came from a very well-established family. His father was a lawyer, a very prominent lawyer. His uncle was the keeper of the Tower of London.
Oh, we're in downtown London.
We're in downtown. Well, I don't know if they call it downtown. But yes, we're in London. And
by 16th century standards.
Yes, by 16th London. Century standards. And London was not nearly as large as it is now, of course.
Of course.
But it was still pretty large. It was easily the largest city in England by far. He was very well educated, Walsingham was. Standard classical education, all of that. He trained for the law, not only in England, but in Switzerland and in Italy. And that was not uncommon. He was well-traveled. That would help him as a spy master, because he's going to be a first-class spy master, probably the best of the 16th century. And when Mary came to the throne in 1553, Mary being a devout Roman Catholic and wanting to take England back into the Catholic Church that her father had broken away from, he left for Europe. He didn't feel it was safe being in England while Mary was reigning. And in fact, Mary would have about 300 Protestants burned at the stake. So Walsingham leaving England was a good idea. He traveled on the continent.
How did she choose her 300 to be burned at the stake?
She had counselors, Catholic counselors and so on. They decided to go after the most prominent, like the Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas Cranmer. I think it was a huge mistake because it turned off the English people toward Catholicism.
That would do it.
I think it would have been better if she had just ignored them or exiled them or something like that.
Wow. So Walsingham thought this was a great time to leave town.
Yeah, and he does. Great time to leave town. That's a good way to put it. And so when Mary died in 1558 at the age of 42, her half-sister Elizabeth became queen. Now, Elizabeth was only 25 years old when she became queen. Nobody knew much about her. She was very well educated. There's no question about that.
And whose daughter is she?
She's the daughter of Henry VIII.
And?
And Anne Boleyn.
The first one to lose her head.
That's right. Henry had three children. He had Mary by his first wife, Catherine of Aragon, and he had his second, Elizabeth, by Anne Boleyn, and he had his third, Edward, by Jane Seymour. Edward reigned first, but he died at 15. In 1553, which is the reason why Mary had to come in and serve for 5 years until she died in 1558.
Now we're up to Elizabeth.
Elizabeth did not embrace Catholicism, to put it mildly. She also was looked upon as a bastard by the Roman Catholic Church because it was considered that Elizabeth's mother's marriage to Henry VIII was illegitimate. It was not valid because he really was married to Catherine of Aragon, according to the Roman Catholic Church. So Elizabeth came in as an unknown quantity. Now, as I've spoken with you many times, I think she was a great, truly great monarch.
Yes, you have mentioned that.
Why she's not called Elizabeth the Great, I do not know. But she would reign for 45 years, from 1558 to 1603. She was masterful. She was clever. She was highly intelligent. She was unscrupulous. She functioned between the twilight of war and diplomacy with great skill. And she was in a perilous condition because both France and Spain were more powerful than England. And, oh, what if they combined these two Catholic powers against England? On top of that, she had to worry about Scotland to the north, which oftentimes made alliances with France against England. So Elizabeth was in a very difficult situation. Fortunately, Elizabeth chose very good men to advise her.
I guess no women were advisors
at that point. No, it was an all-male cast. Her privy council was kept deliberately small, less than 20, but only about 7 or 8 met on a regular basis. One of them was Sir William Cecil, another was Sir Christopher Hatton, and another was Sir Francis Walsingham. Walsingham in the 1560s was in Parliament, and he helped to serve Sir William Cecil, who was her principal secretary in the 1560s, by being in Parliament and being in contact with Cecil, the later Lord Burghley. There was a plot called the Ridolfi Plot in 1571 that Walsingham helped to thwart with Cecil and other privy councillors to assassinate Elizabeth and put Mary Queen of Scots on the throne. Keep in mind, Mary Queen of Scots as of 1568 is in England, having fled Scotland, and she is a prisoner of Elizabeth. She had hoped Elizabeth would help her get back to the Scottish throne, but Mary Queen of Scots was next in line to the throne of England. So if Elizabeth died, the Catholic Mary Queen of Scots would be not only Queen of Scotland, she would be Queen of England.
Now, since this is about Walsingham, I just want to get back to him.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't labeled as spy.
No, this is what occurred. From 1570 to 1573, he was Elizabeth's ambassador to France. He comes back in 1573, and this is when he really starts to do his important work. He becomes a privy councillor in 1573. He becomes a principal secretary of state to Elizabeth in 1573. And he organizes a masterful spy ring throughout Europe. He is this great spy master with contacts in France, in Spain, even in the Ottoman Empire, which was Muslim. He had contacts all over Europe, and he was devoutly Protestant. He was worried about the Catholic world. He was worried about Mary, Queen of Scots. He was worried about plots against Elizabeth.
He had a lot of worries.
He had a lot of worries, and he was great. I mean, he was really good. He had all kinds of sources. He had aides in England who could read cipher very well because they knew many languages and they knew the codes that people would use and decipher them. He had one man who could unseal a sealed envelope and reseal it and no one would know that it had been opened. He just had a plethora.
So instead of him actually being a spy, he just surrounded himself with very capable people.
I think that's a good way to put it. He was the spy master. Yes, he's the one that controlled all these spies in England and throughout the continent. And he foiled a plot called the Throckmorton Plot in 1583. That was another attempt to assassinate Elizabeth. But the plot that he foiled that's the most important is the Babington Plot of 1586.
Ah, the Babington Papers.
Yes, and all of that. Babington was this young man who, in league with others, he was a Roman Catholic, he wanted to assassinate Elizabeth. He wanted Mary, Queen of Scots, placed on the throne of England, and also, of course, on the throne of Scotland. And Walsingham allowed this plot to unfold while having all kinds of access to notes from Mary back and forth.
Oh, so he wanted to see how far it would he had to intervene.
In the previous plots, he couldn't get Mary directly. He didn't have the smoking gun, so to speak, in the Ridolfi plot, in the Throckmorton plot. But in the Babington plot, he got Mary in her own handwriting, authorizing effectively the assassination of her cousin, Elizabeth, so that she could be placed on the throne of England.
But why would you, in your own writing, say, I authorize this?
Well, the way Mary...
Why wouldn't you have other people?
The way Mary wrote it wasn't direct. It was just, it could be implied very easily or readily that that's what she meant. And she thought that she was, there was a way of getting the letters out through a cask of wine, and she thought that that was not something that was discoverable, but Walsingham set the whole thing up, and he knew all about it. So all these secret letters going from Mary, where she was in prison in the castle, I think at Tutbury at the time, she was caught with the goods. And Babington was caught. He was hung, drawn, and quartered.
Oh, that is just...
For our listeners, the really bad part of that is the drawn part. Because you're hung until you're almost dead. Then they take you down and they cut off your genitals. They open up your abdomen, pull out your intestines.
While you're still alive.
While you're still alive. And then after you die, they behead you and they quarter you. They put you into four parts in addition to your head. And then they place those in various areas, prominent places in London and thereabouts as a signal to others that you do not want to engage in treason.
What?
It's a horrible, horrible death. Mary did not have to be hung, drawn, and quartered. She was merely beheaded, as we already covered in our,
Thank goodness, first podcast.
Yes. You would want to be just beheaded.
No kidding.
Yeah. So he caught Mary with the goods, and that was probably his greatest service.
And how was he rewarded for that?
Well, Elizabeth had him as a privy counselor. He was his chief secretary. He had more than enough money and so on. He did it for the service of his nation, for Elizabeth. Elizabeth admired Walsingham a great deal. She didn't always listen to him. She didn't always listen to any of her counselors. She made up her mind, ultimately. And every one of her counselors, very capable men, they knew who the boss was. She was... Well, I think she was terrific. She was just an amazing monarch, an amazing human being. Walsingham also had a lot to do with ferreting out information about the Spanish Armada.
Oh.
Because the Spanish, once Mary was beheaded in February of 87, that's what really set Spain upon conquering England. Because now they could no longer put Mary, Queen of Scots, on the throne of England, and a Catholic monarch was beheaded. Elizabeth was actually angry that Mary was beheaded, and she actually blamed others, although she did sign the death warrant. But that's another story. A poor guy named Ed Davison spent time in the Tower because he actually fulfilled the warrant and took it to have
He was the fall guy.
He was the fall guy, a guy named Davison. But that.
I mean, what else? What were her options?
She was hoping that Mary would be killed privately without her having to sign a warrant authorizing her death.
So it would look like an accident. Oops, she fell down the stairs.
But nobody wanted to do that. The people that were around Elizabeth wanted it done legally. But getting back to Walsingham, he had a lot of information about the impending Spanish armada that was going to conquer England. You know, this huge naval flotilla that was going to
It on its way?
Well,
it was in the planning process.
Well, in 1587, it was stopped for a full year because Sir Francis Drake went down and singed the beard of Spain by burning ships in Cadiz and other places. And Walsingham was instrumental in ensuring that Drake did this. And then the next year in 1588, that's when the Armada finally sailed. And in July and August, they take on the English in the Channel. And to the shock of all of Europe, the greatest power in the world at that time, Spain, was defeated, and England prevailed, and Elizabeth was hailed throughout the Protestant world as a savior. This is what really exalted her to the highest levels, and Walsingham was so instrumental in all of this. He had a lot of information about the Armada, provided it to English commanders like Drake and others. One of the commanders said that to Walsingham that he did more with his pen than many sea captains did with their ships to defeat the Armada.
He had his finger on the pulse, so to speak.
He did. And in 1590, he died of cancer. And Elizabeth was very saddened by that. A lot of Elizabeth's closest advisors would die in the late 1580s into the 1590s, so that by the time she died in 1603, she was largely alone. Very sad.
That is sad.
But that's Walsingham, a great spymaster, preserving the English throne, preserving Elizabeth, and he did a great job. And he finally got Mary, Queen of Scots.
That's something.
All right, so much for Walsingham.
Okay, bye Walsingham, we're moving on.
Well, now we move centuries into the 20th century, World War II era. World War I, World War II
era. Yeah, because when we think of spies, I mean, that's the era that I think
Right. I wanted to do the one on Walsingham because he was just terrific. He was the best spy master in the 16th century.
He was the master. He wasn't the actual spy.
Right.
But now we're going to the actual
spy. When he was in
spies.
France and so on, he did some of his own spying. But yes, he was more of a spy master. Well, the one we're going to do now is a spy master, too. Not so much a spy.
Okay.
This is Wilhelm Canaris. Admiral Wilhelm Canaris.
Sounds very German.
Yes, he was German, although he thought his name Canaris was of Greek descent. It was actually of Italian descent, something like originally it was Canarisi. But his ancestors had moved to Germany long before, so he was born in Germany on New Year's Day, 1887.
Okay.
And at the age of 18, he entered the German Navy. He fought in World War I. He eventually became a submarine commander. He had something like 15 to 20 ships that he sunk. He was looked upon as superb.
This is in World War One.
This is World War One when he's still a very young man. He was also already involved in espionage, too, with respect to ciphers and with respect to things related to that. So he had his hand in espionage as well as being a submarine commander and a very good submarine commander. When World War One ended, of course, Germany was defeated. Many Germans, including Canaris, were crushed by the fact that Germany was now, you know, a defeated nation. The Versailles Treaty was considered humiliating, all of that. And he stayed in the Navy in the 1920s into the 1930s. As Hitler began to rise in the 1920s, and especially as you move into the early 1930s, Canaris became a proponent of Hitler. He admired Hitler. He thought he wanted two things. He wanted an authoritarian leader who would bring Germany back to great power status. And he wanted the Versailles Treaty to be ignored, the various provisions that were so humiliating to Germany about not being able to have an air force, not being able to have an army larger than 100,000 and so on. As with many Germans, he hated that and he wanted that changed. And he saw in Hitler someone who would accomplish
could
that.
Could restore
So
Germany.
He became an ardent admirer of Adolf Hitler, Admiral Canaris did, and he thought that Hitler was the savior for Germany.
Boy, he couldn't be more wrong.
Well, he found that out, as we'll get to. In 1935, Hitler made him the chief of the Abwehr. Abwehr was German military intelligence. So
okay.
He's the head of German military intelligence. By 1937-38, Canaris was having a lot of doubts about Hitler. He had one incident in 1938 when it was dealing with Czechoslovakia and the Sudetenland, and we covered that in one or more podcasts one way or another, and Hitler just lost it. He was had an audience with Hitler, and Hitler just lost it on him, and he just went into this rage, and Canaris was, I think that might have been one of the incidents that made him realize that this is a man who should not be running Germany.
Yeah, you're dealing with a crazy person.
Yeah. This is Canaris by 1938 had realized that.
But now he's so deep in the thick of things.
That's right. So what he does, what's so interesting is he still continues to function for Germany and for Nazi Germany, for Hitler, and he does a lot of work for Hitler. But at the same time, he's playing a double game. He's a spy master. He's the one who's controlling, as Walsingham did, a lot of spies throughout Europe, etc. I'll give you a couple examples here in America. He set up the Duquesne spy ring. The Duquesne spy ring in America in the late 30s into early 40s, even before America got into the war, was composed of some 33 individuals who were spying here in America on America. They were led by a man named Fritz Duquesne, who was originally from South Africa. He was a piece of work in his own right. He was an amazing individual in many ways. And the Duquesne spy ring was eventually caught in 1941. It was set up by Canaris. It was caught in 1941 by the FBI, with J. Edgar Hoover was the head of.
Right.
And they were prosecuted. And a lot of them had turned themselves in. Others were prosecuted. They were giving something like a total of 300 years in prison. So the Duquesne spy ring was the brainchild of Canaris, and it basically was foiled by the FBI by late 1941, just about the time we're getting into the war.
Well, that's good.
Canaris also set up something else in America. Once America did get into the war, once Hitler declared war in Germany in December of 41, shortly after Pearl Harbor.
Hitler declared war on?
Yes. What happened was, you know, Pearl Harbor occurs on December 7th, 41.
Right.
And Hitler, within 4 days, I think it was December 11th, declared war on America.
Ah, see, you said declared war on Germany. That's
oh,
what
I'm
just
sorry. Did I
wanted
say
to clarify.
War? No, I have to take that one back.
Yeah, take it back.
Yeah. And so in 1942, something called the Operation Pastorius was set up by Canaris. And this was a operation with eight German Abwehr agents, military intelligence agents, two of whom happened to be American citizens working for German military intelligence. They were trained in explosives and all of those sorts of things. They were come to America, and they were to blow up a lot of things, like a hydroelectric...
So they're not coming through immigration and all that.
And they're not coming to spy. They're coming to do great damage to America's
infrastructure.
They did.
Through Mexico?
No, I don't think through Mexico. They came by way of New York, etc. They were caught pretty soon after they came in, though. By the way, being from Blair County, Pennsylvania, I just wanted to mention that one of the sites that was to be blown up was the Horseshoe Curve. And
in Altoona.
That's right, in Altoona. And in fact, the Altoona Railroad Shops, where my grandfather worked for over 50 years on the Pennsylvania Railroad, they were to be blown up too. They were considered...
There was a chance that you wouldn't be here today if
at least my grandfather would have... By that time, my father was born, my grandfather might have been harmed, yes. The Altoona Railroad Shops were just about the largest railroad shops in the world in the 1930s and 40s. So to disrupt that kind of rail traffic and to blow up the Horseshoe Curve, which was the most difficult part of the entire rail route between New York and Chicago, would have been a real victory for the Germans and to blow up other things.
How far did they get to doing that?
They didn't get anywhere. They got caught right away.
Thank goodness.
And they were... six of them were sentenced to death. The two that had turned themselves in got a long time in prison. But getting back to Canaris...
So he's 0-2 at this point.
Well, he's 0-2 in the United States, but he's doing a lot of work for Hitler that is effective in Europe. In 1939, when Hitler invaded Poland to begin World War II, Canaris made a trip to Poland, and he was appalled at the destruction in Warsaw and the massive...
Was this after the ghettos were set up?
The ghettos were set up just about the time that...
So he saw the ghettos.
Well, it wasn't so much he saw the ghettos. The ghettos would have been set up shortly thereafter or almost at the same time. It wasn't so much the ghettos that appalled him. It was just the massive destruction, the death overall. And he actually had a conversation with a major general, Keitel, who was a major advisor to Hitler. And he said, this will bring a stain on the Wehrmacht, on the German military forever, what you're doing. And Keitel's response was, well... It's already been decided by the Führer. And this just sickened Canaris more with respect to how inimical Hitler was to German interests. Because you have this German patriot in Canaris. And yeah, he's an authoritarian. And yeah, he did back Hitler. But now he's playing a double game.
Now he's stuck.
He's still head of the Abwehr, military intelligence.
Right.
But he is providing information to the British. He's providing information to the Americans. He had a Polish mistress in Switzerland. He would visit Switzerland on occasion. Switzerland was neutral in World War II. Hitler thought about taking over Switzerland. Canaris actually talked him out of it. And so he had this Polish mistress, Helena Szymanska, and she was a British agent. So he would pass information to her. So
and he knew she was a British agent.
He knew she was a British agent.
Oh, so this was purposefully done.
He also had a good friend of his was General Francisco Franco. Canaris spoke six languages fluently. He was perfectly fluent in Spanish, and he had many conversations with Franco. He actually had a picture or a photo of Franco in his office. I mean, they were almost buddies. And he visited Spain many times, and he told Franco, don't let Hitler go through Spain to take Gibraltar. I don't think Franco would have allowed that anyway, but Canaris is telling Franco, listen, you want to stay neutral. You don't want to get hooked up with Hitler, etc. And so he was giving Franco very good advice. He actually turned up one time in Istanbul.
Canaris
in Turkey, yeah, at the door of a man named George Earle. George Earle was an American who was sent by FDR as a kind of roving envoy in the Balkans and Turkey and so on to report back to FDR on matters going on there during World War II. George Earle had previously been governor of Pennsylvania.
Small world.
Yes, and Earle was a very interesting man in his own right. He was the Democratic governor of Pennsylvania from 35 to 39. And Canaris shows up at his door in Istanbul one day. And Canaris's proposal was to Earle was that there should be a ceasefire in the Western Front. The Germans will stop fighting the Americans and the British if they invade. This was in 43, so they knew they were coming in 44. And there should be a ceasefire with the British, with the Americans. And Hitler would be turned over to the Americans and the British, or assassinated, one of the two, and the Germans would just continue fighting the Soviets on the Eastern Front. Earle reported this back to FDR. FDR wanted nothing to do with it. FDR's response was, nope, unconditional surrender. Canaris also had a...
Wait, hang on.
Yeah.
How come Canaris isn't being trailed? Why aren't people seeing he's doing things that are questionable?
He is so clever. I agree with you. It's just amazing how he got away with this.
How did he get away with all
this? He got away with this for so long. Now, he's doing some things to help Hitler, while at the same time he's doing things to undermine Hitler. He went to Spain in 1943 and had a conversation with Wild Bill Donovan of the OSS and Mangus of MI6, British intelligence. And he gave the same proposal. Look, we'll have a ceasefire with the British and the Americans. We'll hand Hitler over to you, or we'll kill him, one of the two, and just let us continue fighting against the Russians. And Wild Bill Donovan got this back to FDR. Mangus got this back to Churchill. They said, nope, unconditional surrender. I wonder if that was a mistake.
It does make you wonder.
It does. I mean,
well, they thought in reality that plan wouldn't work.
Well, maybe they did, but both FDR and Churchill said, nope, unconditional surrender. In fact, FDR was mad at Donovan, the head of the OSS, for even having this conversation with Canaris. But Canaris is doing all this stuff. He's going to Switzerland. He's going to Turkey.
And also, how do they know, the Americans and the Brits, how do they know they can trust this guy?
Well, that's a good question. They didn't know that. They didn't know if he was deliberately setting them up.
That's what I would think.
Yes, they didn't know that. That is a factor that needs to be considered. FDR and Churchill might have thought that he's doing this actually as a kind of, you know, duplicity of the First Order. So nothing came from that. By 1944, Canaris was really beginning to be suspected by the SS, by Hitler, and so on. Once the great bomb plot of July 20th, 1944 occurred, by the way, the Abwehr was done away with in February of 44. Hitler just did away with it and let the SS be the intelligence agency through their SD department. And Canaris is now under suspicion. The bomb plot against Hitler in July of 44, which failed, made Canaris even more suspect.
Did he have anything to do with that?
There was no evidence that they had at the time, although he knew people that were involved with it. But by 1945, they had uncovered his diary, and they had realized that he did have at least knowledge of it, if he did not have anything to
instigate. Why on earth would you keep a diary?
I don't know.
As a military officer.
I mean, I don't think it has anything to do with the lack of intelligence. Who knows? Maybe he wanted it to survive the war. But they arrested him eventually.
Yeah, right. It'll implicate you in any situation.
Well, Canaris was eventually put in Flossenbürg concentration camp in Bavaria.
So what exactly were the charges, do we know?
Treason.
Okay.
Yeah, treason. And he was brutally treated. He was horribly treated in jail. Eventually, on April 9th, 1945, just 2 weeks before the Americans liberated Flossenbürg concentration camp, he was led, along with others like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the Protestant minister who opposed Hitler, to their death. And they were humiliated. They were they had to go to their death naked.
And is this in front of a firing squad?
They were hung.
Chair?
They were hung.
They were hung.
And it took a long time. They made sure that the hanging was. It was a brutal death. This Canaris actually is applauded by the Jewish community. To this day, like at the Jewish Virtual Library, which is an internet site, he's applauded as saving hundreds of Jews. There was one point where he saved about 500 Dutch Jews from being sent to death camps. There was another time when there were 7 or 8 Jews that Himmler wanted to send to the death camps, and Canaris was able to pass them off as military intelligence agents and save those Jews. So if you go to the Jewish Virtual Library, they actually praise Canaris. Yes, they criticize him for originally supporting Hitler and for being a Nazi and for all of that. But they praise him for realizing his error and then doing all this work behind the scenes to thwart Hitler, to get rid of Hitler, because he saw that Hitler was destroying Germany. So this is an extraordinary man, a great spy master like Walsingham, brilliant across the board. As I mentioned, he spoke
except
six
for
languages.
The personal diary.
Well... In any case, I think by that time they would have killed him anyway. I think
they probably had enough information.
Oh yeah,
on
him. I think that they. I mean, in the last months of the war, the SS were killing people left and right. They knew they were going to lose the war, but they were going to kill all these people anyway. And Canaris missed being saved by the Americans by about 2 weeks.
Do we know what happened to his family?
I don't know what happened to. He married a woman. Her last name was Vaag, V-A-A-G. I don't know if they touched his family or not. The Nazis, after the bomb plot of July 44, went after many families.
Right.
And I don't know what happened to Canaris' family.
And his mistress.
Right. Well, his mistress, the Polish mistress, was in Switzerland. She was a British agent. She was in a neutral country.
So she just probably...
Helena Zeminska. Yeah. She was a
hung
very...
Hung out there for the rest of the
war.
She
was a very capable woman, too, like Virginia Hall. But Canaris What a mixed legacy.
So what, was he buried, do we know?
Yes.
Was he incinerated?
Right. Was he incinerated? I think he was. I don't, you know, that's a good question. I don't know if he was buried. I think he might have been cremated. I don't know.
Because I would think the Germans wanted to destroy right. any.
But he died on April 9th, 1945.
A horrible yeah. death.
And he's praised by many individuals. The Danes praised him. The Jews praised him. Franco praised him. Many individuals praised him.
But nobody could save him.
He was also in contact with Pope Pius XII and provided the Vatican a lot of information about Hitler.
Well, that's a whole episode right there, right. Pope Pius XII.
Yes, we could do an entire episode on Pius XII.
Because there seems to be a lot of misinformation out there about him.
Yeah, well, it depends.
It depends Pius on the
source. Pius XII is controversial. I've studied him for a long time now. I think that he did a lot of great work and is unfairly criticized, but that is a perspective of mine, which is disagreed with by others.
It is indubitably.
Yes, and now we move on to our third spy.
Moving right along.
Moving right along. Now we're going to deal with someone who is not a spy master, like Walsingham and Canaris was. This is Richard Sorge. Richard Sorge was born in October of 1895 in what is now Azerbaijan. His father was a mining engineer, and he was born in the Caucasus. His mother was Russian. His father was German. And
he was a mix.
He was a mix. He had German citizenship because of his father.
So he probably started bilingually from a very early age.
Sorge would eventually speak six languages fluently: German, Russian, French, English, Chinese, and Japanese.
Oh my gosh.
His Japanese was perfect, and he knew a great deal about China. He would actually write a book about Chinese agriculture, but I'm getting ahead of myself.
Okay, I know. Okay. It's fascinating, though. Okay.
Yeah, Tom Clancy called him the greatest spy in history. Ian Fleming said he is the most formidable spy in history. Douglas MacArthur said he was devastatingly effective as a spy. Frederick Forsyth, the author of many great novels like The Day of the Jackal, and The Odessa File, later made into movies,
right.
said that you could count on the fingers of one hand how many spies in history have influenced the entire history of this planet. Richard Sorge is one of them.
Wow, what a guy.
Sorge entered the army in World War I, fought for the Germans in World War I. He had a
So he's a young guy at this point.
Yeah, 1895. So World War I begins in 1914. So he's, 19 years old, something like that. And he had devastating injuries in World War I. Three of his fingers were severed from shrapnel, and he had both legs broken severely, and he would have a limp for the rest of his life because of that. After the war, he completely switched from being a right-wing nationalist, a very ardent supporter of the Kaiser and all that, to a communist. He would actually join.
That's a big change.
That's a big change, because when he was in prison recuperating from his severe injuries.
Oh, wait, he was captured?
He wasn't captured. He was just put in a German hospital.
Because of his injuries. Not a prison.
Right. And when he was recovering in World War I in the hospital, he read a great deal of Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels.
Oh, no, not those two again.
And, he became a total Marxist. He felt that. So he did a complete 180 from being far right to far left. In 1919, he joined the German Communist Party. In 1919, he also got a PhD in political science from the University of Hamburg. Once he joined the Communist Party, very shortly thereafter, he came to the attention of the Soviets because, by this time, the Soviet Union existed. Lenin had come in 1917.
Of all the people in all the world, why him in particular?
He had great capacities, and people realized that about him. He had this star presence. He was absolutely brilliant. As I mentioned, he spoke six languages eventually. People who met him were stunned by his brilliance, by his effectiveness. He was also a babe magnet. He was a great womanizer.
Oh, a true James Bond.
Yes. Well, eventually it would be called Stalin's James Bond. He also lived life on the edge in many ways. He was a heavy drinker. People knew that he could outdrink almost anyone. He loved motorcycles. He was in a major accident on one occasion because he was going so fast. This is a guy who lived life on the edge.
He's a dude.
And apparently he was immensely charming with women. He would bed other men's wives.
Let's see.
Yeah. So he joins a German Communist Party in 1919. In the early 1920s, he's recruited by the Soviets. So he becomes a Soviet spy. in the early
1920s. Oh, he's recruited as a spy.
Yes.
Okay.
So he's recruited as a spy because don't forget, if you're a true Marxist, if you're a true communist, really that is what is most important, not your, not the nation state. So he's a German, although he has a Russian mother, he's a German who is now going to spy for the Soviet Union.
And this is between wars.
Yes, this is the 1920s.
Okay.
So he goes back to Germany, he poses as a journalist, provides information back to the Soviet Union. In 1929, two things occur. He joins the GRU, which is Soviet Military Intelligence. And the second thing he does, and I think you'll be just fascinated by this, he joins the Nazi Party.
No.
Yes. As
but he's a Marxist.
It's all deception. He convinces the Nazis that he's given up on his communism, and now he's a great admirer.
And he believed him?
They completely believed him. Right. And he read Mein Kampf in the 1920s, Hitler's turgid two-volume work. Almost nobody could read it. He read it. People said he had it almost memorized. He knew Nazism inside and out, and the Nazis bought it that he was one of them, and he was. This is part of the reason why he was such a masterful spy.
Amazing.
And it was so dangerous of him. I mean, the Nazis obviously would have known that he had been a communist at one time, and now know he's doing another Volt-Fast, another 180-degree turn, and he's becoming a loyal Nazi. And he even convinced Joseph Goebbels that he was a loyal Nazi.
Wow, that's impressive.
And in 1930, he ends up in China because of the civil war there between Mao and the communists and Chiang Kai-shek and the nationalists. He comes back to Germany. He writes a book on Chinese agriculture. Is that obscure or what? But his real work as a Soviet spy begins in 1933 when he is sent to Japan. He is sent to Japan as a Nazi. Remember, Japan and Germany are allies in World War II.
Oh, right.
You know, the Axis. He is sent to Japan as a Nazi German journalist for the Frankfurter Zeitung. I think the Frankfurter Zeitung had the largest circulation in Germany. I think it was the most popular.
That's a newspaper?
Yeah, a newspaper.
Okay.
And so here he is functioning as a Nazi journalist, while all the while he is a Soviet communist spy.
Whoa. We're getting multi-layered here.
He actually, he knew so much about Japan, the language, the culture, the history, everything, that he was considered by many to be the most informed person in Japan by any Westerner in Japan. He had Japanese mistresses.
Of course he did.
Right. He had gotten married twice. The first person he married was a wife of his professor at Hamburg, and the second one was a Russian. But he had many affairs. He ingratiated himself with the German ambassador to Tokyo, Herbert von Dirksen. Dirksen was amazed by Sorge. And when Dirksen wanted information on the Japanese and how the Japanese might think about something or whatever, he relied upon Sorge. And Sorge's writing all this stuff for the Frankfurter Zeitung, posing as this devout Nazi, advising the German ambassador to Tokyo. When von Dirksen was replaced by a man named Eugene Ott, he became his advisor as well.
Ott was as
enthralled with Sorge as von Dirksen had been. And, oh, by the way, just in passing, Sorge was sleeping with Ott's wife.
Wow.
And Ott knew it and didn't really mind.
He said,
Sorge's so charming, I just can't hold it against him.
They probably had a threesome. What the hell?
I don't know about a threesome. And he had Japanese mistresses. And he's working with a Japanese communist, Hatsumi Ozaki, who's actually an advisor to the Japanese prime minister. So Sorge's functioning at the highest level in Japan. He's giving Stalin all kinds of great information.
How is he getting the information back to Stalin?
He had one source after another. I'm just amazed at this guy. He really was a James Bond figure.
So he would just pass messages and code?
Oh, they were encrypted very carefully, the way he did it, and they would be changed all the time. And this went on for years. In 1941, he told Stalin that within 2 days of when Hitler was going to invade the Soviet Union in Operation Barbarossa, I think he said June 20th, it was June 22nd. That's how much information he got from the German consulate or a ministry in Tokyo, that he was able to tell Stalin, look, they're going to invade. They're going to invade probably on June 20th. Stalin kind of ignored that.
Stalin really wasn't ready for
that. Well, Stalin was really paranoid. He thought everybody was out to get him. He wondered if Sorge wasn't a British spy, as a, you know, a double agent for Britain, but he really wasn't. Sorge was really devoted to communism. He's the one, Sorge's the one who, in September of 41, who told Stalin that the because Stalin was really worried about the Japanese invading the Eastern Soviet Union, Eastern Russia.
Oh, right.
And Sorge conveyed to Stalin in September of 41 that the Japanese had no intention at that time of invading Russia. They were going south into the Southern Pacific area.
Oh, the South Pacific.
Yeah, all of that. That there was no intention of them, that they were going to go after America. Sorge indicated to Stalin in September of 41 that the Japanese were going to go after the Americans, which, of course, would occur in December.
I was going to say, did the Americans not get wind of that?
Americans knew that it was very likely the Japanese were going to attack someplace by late 41.
They thought 41. It was Guam or
they
something
They thought it could
like
be
that.
Guam. They thought it could be the Philippines. They didn't know if it might be Wake Island. They did take into account that it could be Hawaii, Pearl Harbor, but they thought that it wouldn't be a military attack. They thought it would be some kind of espionage attack, attack along those lines. The idea that FDR knew beforehand that Pearl Harbor was going to be bombed. No serious historian adheres to that. I know that's a conspiracy theory. That's
a conspiracy
theory. FDR knew so he could get us into the war. What FDR knew and what other people like George Marshall knew was that it was very likely the Japanese were going to attack someplace, but they didn't know where, they didn't know how.
Sorge knew.
And he told Stalin. And by telling Stalin in September of 41 the Japanese weren't going to move into Russia, this allowed Stalin to move many divisions, Siberian divisions, from Eastern Russia to Western Russia to fight the Germans, which changed the entire landscape of the war. You can see how influential Sorge is.
So now Stalin is starting to believe him.
Maybe. In October of 41, the Japanese had started to become suspicious of Sorge. Keep in mind, he'd been in Japan most of the last 8 years. And by the way, in the 1920s, he traveled other places. He traveled to Britain. He traveled to the United States. He did a study on the Hollywood film industry. Because there were many, in 1927, he was in California. This guy was all over the place. He was in China. He was back in Germany many times. He was in Japan. He was everywhere. This is just an amazing human being. And he's, you know, drinking hard, has mistresses, betting wives, providing all this information, posing as a Nazi while he's really a Soviet spy. And when the Japanese finally caught on to him, and he was arrested in October of 41, and at first, they thought he was an Abwehr agent. They thought he was a German military intelligence agent spying on the Japanese. Because remember when we've done previous work on spies, etc., a lot of times friendly powers spy
on each other.
And the Japanese originally thought he was a German spy, but then they came to realize that he was a Soviet spy. And he would remain in prison.
I wonder how they figured it out.
They were getting suspicious over the course of a long period of time. And finally, in October, I don't know what the smoking gun was.
I was just going to
say. And they also arrested Hatsumi Ozaki, the Japanese communist that Sorge had worked with.
Uh-oh.
He would remain in prison for 3 years. The Japanese actually, when they found out he was a Soviet spy, they actually were willing to exchange him for some Japanese spy, one or more Japanese spies, but Stalin didn't want anything to do with it. Stalin even denied that Sorge was a spy. He let him rot in the vine.
That's just so typical of Stalin.
Yeah. And so Sorge made a deal with the Japanese that if he would let the women involved with the espionage in Japan, he would tell them everything. And they agreed to that.
Who were probably his lovers.
Yes, that if they would leave them alone, he would tell them everything. He told them everything.
So he really did.
Yeah.
He was telling the truth.
Right. He was telling the truth by 1944. And the Japanese in November, they prosecuted him, of course.
Was he being tortured while he was in prison?
I think so. I think he was tortured at times. Yes. Right. And but this is as tough a human being as you can find anywhere. I mean, I think he spied for a bad cause, Marxism and communism, but no one can deny his ability.
Right.
He is just extraordinary. In fact, the chief Japanese prosecutor who prosecuted Sorge said he was the greatest human being he ever knew.
That's pretty high praise.
That's pretty high praise. Yeah. In November of 1944, Sorge was executed. He was hung.
He was hung, too?
Yeah, he was hung.
What happened to the firing squads?
And spies oftentimes were hung. They weren't given the dignity of a firing squad. Matahari was.
She sure was. Thank goodness. But
he was hung. So at the age of 49, Sorge perished. After his death, he kind of becomes this negative figure. I mean, certainly in West Germany, when it was found out he had been a Soviet spy in the 1950s and 60s, he was looked upon as an enemy of Germany. Stalin had disavowed him, but of course, once Stalin dies in 53 and Khrushchev comes into power by 55, Khrushchev began to look at this guy named Sorge, and it was like, this guy was amazing and did great work for the Soviet Union. So by 1964, he was given all kinds of honors by the Soviet Union. There was a stamp issued with his portrayal on it. He was made a hero of the Soviet Union. That's a certain title that was very honorary. So as of 1964, in the communist world, he was finally realized for the great spy that he was. And even those who did not embrace Marxism and communism realized how great he was and how he changed the history of World War II.
I wonder what happened to him after he was hung.
He was actually thrown into a common pit. But his Japanese mistress, who wouldn't die until 2000.
Wow.
Yes. She was able to find his body. His corpse. Because of the hallmark of his broken legs in World War I.
Oh, and his fingers.
And so she was able to identify he was cremated. And he was buried in Japan. He's still buried in Japan. And when she died in 2000, she was cremated, and her ashes are with him.
Well, I'm glad that his body was found. And
yes, absolutely one of the greatest spies who ever lived.
I mean, he truly sounds like what the films are based on.
I'm just amazed at how well he knew China and Japan. I mean, his Chinese was perfect.
Just to speak the language.
His Japanese was perfect. He knew everything about Japan. I mean, from cuisine to literature to culture to history, the language. He was just amazing. Richard Sorge, maybe the greatest spy who ever lived. Being a spy is a dangerous business.
Well, it seems like most of them end up dead.
I mean, at least Walsingham died in his bed, but Canaris was hung, and so was Sorge.
It's fascinating.
Three truly great spies.
Wow. Speaking of fascinating topics.
Yes.
We have a great one for our next episode.
Oh, yes. I think we're going to do something very different. We're going to deal with Cuba.
Because yes. It's so much in the news right now.
Right. We'll deal with
it. Do people really know?
Right.
We'll deal with its history.
We'll deal with, Batista, Castro, all of that.
I think it'll be
fascinating. The Spanish occupation of it for centuries. Yeah.
Cuba Libre. All right. Well, thank you, listeners, for being here. We so appreciate your support. Yeah. And we will see you in a couple of weeks.
Yes. 2 weeks from now, Cuba.
So until then, stay well, stay safe, and we're signing off.
Goodbye.
Well, friends, here we are at the end of the podcast. Be sure to check out the links in the show description to find some of the resources we used for this episode. Also, if you've enjoyed listening, please head over to Apple Podcasts and give us a virtual high five by leaving us a 5-star review. We'd really appreciate that. And if you'd like to connect with us directly, you can find us at historicallyspeakingpodcast.com or follow us on Instagram at historicallyspeakingpodcast. That's it for today, and again, thanks for sharing part of your day with us. And remember, if you want to know what the future holds, study the past.